Julie Grant. This week on the Allegheny Front, an investigation reveals lax oversight of radioactive solid waste from the fracking industry in Pennsylvania.
One of my sources referred to this as a logistical mess. It's unclear where and how waste is being tracked.
Also, a surprise amount of climate pollution could be reduced in a material that's often just below our feet, concrete, used in sidewalks and construction.
The same time that there are efforts to decarbonize this industry, there's going to be a lot more concrete being used globally.
And one couple is linking their love of birds with their music and dance performances.
So we're in the little baby bird phase of our project. That's why we would call this a creative play date.
How they're connecting bird calls with art. That's all coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. 3 environmental groups are objecting to an air quality permit granted to a proposed natural gas plant in Indiana County. Rachel McDevitt reports the plant is meant to power a massive data center at the site of the former Homer City coal-fired power plant.
The proposed 4.5-gigawatt gas-fired plant would generate enough power for more than 3 million homes and emit more greenhouse gases each year than all the cars on Pennsylvania's roads, according to the groups appealing the permit. But Lawrence Hayfitz with Clean Air Council says the power plant is only one piece of the planned 3,200-acre data center campus.
You can't look at the environmental impacts of a project unless you look at the totality of the project.
Clean Air Council, Penn Future, and Sierra Club say the State Department of Environmental Protection made several errors by granting the permit, including failure to follow its own environmental justice policy and accepting flawed methodology for the amount of emissions the plant will create. They also say letting this plant go forward is a violation of the state's Environmental Rights Amendment. The company behind the project, Homer City Generation, declined to comment. Rachel McDevitt, 90.5 WESA News.
Well, we've had a proper winter so far in our region with frigid temperatures, ice, and snow. And that means salt is being applied to freeways, streets, and parking lots to help keep them safe. But that salt can damage waterways. Newly gathered data shows the salt lingers in groundwater for decades and shows up in rivers and streams months after winter storms. John Jackson is a senior scientist with the Stroud Water Research Center in Chester County. The group had 700 volunteers collect water samples in October. Jackson says the results were overwhelming. More than half the sites sampled had salt levels above EPA thresholds for sustaining aquatic life. He says it's from decades of salt that's run off roads and parking lots and into the groundwater.
That's why our streams are salty in July and August, September, October, November, December, before we ever apply any more salt. That's just salt from last year or from 10 years ago or 20 years ago coming out of the groundwater into the stream water.
The high salt content can also kill small aquatic insects, which are food for fish. Jackson says communities and private landowners could use a lot less salt and still keep roads safe. Residential solar tax credits expired at the end of last year, thanks to the big tax bill President Trump signed into law this summer. But solar installers say there's still an affordable way to do rooftop arrays. From the climate desk at WHYY News, Susan Phillips reports on new funding for Philadelphia area residents that takes advantage of a remaining tax credit.
Leasing remains an affordable option for some residents. That's where a third party owns the solar array and gets a 30% commercial tax credit, which it then passes on to the homeowner. Annika Wister-Jones runs America Bright, which provides an option for Pennsylvania residents to get solar panels with no upfront costs. The program is expanding in Southeast Pennsylvania with more than $3 million in new investment.
Solar is a really huge opportunity for everyday people to take part in the fight against climate change and make real savings on monthly utilities.
Wister-Jones says the monthly lease payments are typically lower than residential PICO bills. homeowners who make less than $165,000 a year could qualify. From the Climate Desk, I'm Susan Phillips, WHYY News.
Just this week, President Trump announced that the U.S. is pulling out of the bedrock United Nations Treaty on Climate Change. Still, some states are moving ahead to address greenhouse gas emissions. As Zoe Reed reports, Delaware announced its climate action plan that outlines goals for reducing fossil fuels.
The non-binding plan outlines a path to achieve net zero emissions by 2050. That includes increasing the state's solar capacity, expanding access to electric vehicles, and preparing the state for clean hydrogen. The plan comes as the Trump administration has cut clean energy funding and prioritizes fossil fuels. Greg Patterson is the secretary of Delaware's Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. He says climate change must be tackled on the state level.
It is up to us to keep trying to work towards them, even knowing that it's going to be a little harder to do without the federal resources that even a year ago we thought we could count on.
He calls for efforts to sequester carbon, such as planting more trees or expanding wetlands. From the Climate Desk, Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
With the federal government pushing for more fossil fuel production, that could mean more fracking in Pennsylvania and more radioactive waste. An investigation by Inside Climate News finds that oversight is lacking. The process of fracking a well brings up gas or oil from deep underground. There's been a lot of reporting about the radioactivity and other problems with waste water from the drilling process.
But there has been a lot less attention paid to the solid waste, even though the solid waste often has similar characteristics as the wastewater, and we are producing huge volumes of it every year.
Kylie Benz is a reporter with Inside Climate News. She recently published a three-part series taking a deep dive into the solid waste from the gas industry in Pennsylvania. How much is there? Where do oil and gas producers send it? And who's paying attention? I asked her to describe this waste.
Solid waste that's created from fracking can cover a pretty wide range of materials, including things like drill cuttings. We're talking about rocks. Some of this stuff is contaminated by chemicals and by radioactive elements that are coming from deep underground. And this is one of the reasons that it can be contaminated with things like heavy metals and radioactive elements like radium.
How much of this waste is produced from fracking companies and other drillers in Pennsylvania?
We found that over the past 8 years, there's been millions of tons of this waste being produced. Because DEP, the State Department of Environmental Protection in Pennsylvania, is very understaffed, they don't have the resources to do regular audits of these numbers. And so while we can give kind of a ballpark figure, we can't say definitively how much the waste is.
In your investigation, what did you uncover about the state's efforts to track where this waste is going?
It was one of those situations where the more you learn about it, the less you feel like you know. The state has a number of different ways of tracking the waste. So one is this database that operators submit their own numbers to. It's being updated all the time because operators submit monthly. But then there are also a number of other databases and programs that are doing some parts of tracking this waste. One of my sources referred to this as a logistical mess. It's unclear where and how each piece of waste is being tracked because we have different departments within the Department of Environmental Protection are tracking the waste. And there's not really anybody looking at the big picture and making sure that all the numbers correspond to each other and make sense.
Yeah, and why is it important, do you think, to track?
When there's a spill or a leak or something goes wrong at a well pad, or we have an instance of like illegal dumping, it's a lot harder to figure out where that waste came from, who might be doing it, to enforce regulations around those things if you don't know what the waste is or where it came from, or if you don't have accurate numbers to compare these things to.
And you report that more information is coming out about the radioactivity of this waste. Can you talk about that?
So I talked to scientists at the University of Pittsburgh who have done research, new research, using DEP records, where they found that the radioactivity in the fracking waste that's being produced over the last few years, it's much more radioactive than the DEP's earlier numbers. It's also much more radioactive than numbers that were used by the federal government in 2011. And I think this is important because a lot of the state's positions or how they're thinking about regulating the waste is based on those older numbers, that older data. And now we have new information that the waste might be a lot more radioactive than we previously thought. So we might want to rethink how we are regulating it. We want to make sure that workers are safe, for example, because they're the ones who would be most exposed to it. And it's just really crucial information to have when you're thinking about how do we handle the waste.
You also talk about the radioactive monitors going off when trucks containing oil and gas waste are coming into landfills. Can you talk about sort of how often that's happening and what we should take from that?
These are special alarms that are at the entrances to landfills. They go off when the truckload exceeds a certain amount of radioactivity. I think the numbers that we found in 2023, alarms at landfills in Pennsylvania went off more than 500 times because of oil and gas waste. And Pennsylvania actually is kind of ahead of other states on this. Like, we have stricter regulations than other states do for our landfills in this particular instance. And so that's useful for giving us some data about what type of waste is coming into the landfills and, you know, how radioactive it is.
And you spoke with some activists who have been watching waterways near the Westmoreland Sanitary Landfill south of Pittsburgh, where there have been some problems. What are the dangers here?
The people who have been really watching the Westmoreland Landfill in Belle Vernon are really concerned about water contamination. There's been a number of violations and issues at that landfill over the years. It's also a landfill that has taken a lot of oil and gas waste over the years. And residents nearby, you know, have complained about odors or just impacts of that waste they've noticed from living nearby. Activists now are visiting sites downstream from the landfill regularly to conduct testing and to check to see if there's any evidence that contaminated water from the landfill could be getting into public waterways. You know, it wouldn't be the first time in my investigation I'd looked at all of the landfills across Pennsylvania that take oil and gas waste. And then I also looked at records, federal records for the waterways near those landfills. And there is evidence that in some cases there's contamination happening from the landfills into the waterways. In some cases, it seems likely that that contamination is connected to oil and gas waste because what they've found is radium, which is a common contaminant in oil and gas waste.
Yeah. And one thing you mentioned in one of your stories was that there are a lot of eyes now on that one landfill, but there are something like 20 other landfills in the state that are accepting oil and gas waste that maybe don't have as many people watching.
I think this is a really critical point. So there's at least 22 other landfills that are currently accepting oil and gas waste. There may be others that accepted it in the past, like before the period of time that we looked at. And most of them do not have anywhere near the level of scrutiny that the Westmoreland landfill has, partly because they tend to be in rural areas. There just aren't that many people around. And people, you know, they just don't know that this waste is coming into the landfill in such large volumes. You know, if nobody's doing regular testing of the waterways near the landfill, you know, people just don't know.
You know, I think you were looking into this for a number of months. Did anything in this time really surprise you?
I think I was most surprised by the numbers that new research from the University of Pittsburgh found in terms of how radioactive the waste was. It was much, much higher than previous estimates. And there's just huge implications for those numbers. It really requires further research and study and also follow-up from our government about what they're doing to make sure that, you know, not just over the short term, but over the long term, because we were talking about radioactive waste, what does it mean that we are producing this huge volume of waste every year, that much of it is radioactive? You know, what are the long-term potential consequences, and are we doing enough to protect the environment and also public health?
Thanks, Kylie.
Thank you.
Kylie Benz is a reporter with Inside Climate News. You can find her three-part series about solid waste from the fracking industry on our website, AlleghenyFront.org. A couple that birds together can make music and other forms of art together. That's kind of the idea behind a new project being led by a birding couple. They're linking their ornithological fascination to their art, exploring film, music, dance, and more.
And then the vibe took hold, as it's known to do. Riffing off the sound of the trumpeter swan, the musicians started immediately forming a melody, and the dancers started a rhythmic conversation, accentuated by the exotic beats coming from the percussion.
Making birds into bandmates, that's coming up on the Allegheny Front. When you're on a sidewalk, have you ever stopped to think about concrete? No? Well, me neither. But it turns out concrete contributes a significant amount of carbon emissions each year. Sophia Schmidt reports researchers at the University of Pennsylvania are trying to develop more sustainable options.
A white concrete pavilion outside of the Pennovation Center has a strange roof. The ceiling is organic looking, hollowed out with small rounded cavities. The pavilion's an example of the concrete forms that Penn architecture professor Masoud Akbarzadeh's lab designs. His research team models the flow of forces inside structures like floors or bridges, then 3D prints concrete forms with support only where it's needed.
It allows us to reduce the amount of material and also, in the meantime, achieve really efficient structural forms for architectural spaces.
Engineering professor Xu Yang is working on alternative concrete recipes that absorb more carbon from the air than conventional concrete. The researchers say combining these two approaches could significantly lower the carbon footprint of a concrete floor. From the Climate Desk, I'm Sophia Schmidt, WHYY News.
So, what is concrete, actually? It's used to pave highways and build the foundations of lots of buildings. Investigative journalist Ames Alexander looked into the science and politics of it and says the climate problems actually stem from the cement that's kind of the binding agent inside of concrete. Cement is like glue that's mixed with sand and gravel to make concrete. And it's the cement that has the big carbon footprint. Last year, Alexander spoke with the Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple about how the industry is looking to decarbonize, but its efforts are being challenged by the Trump administration.
So how big of a climate issue is cement and why?
Yeah, so the cement industry is a major contributor to global warming. It's responsible for 8% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. If the industry were a country, its emissions would rival those of many large nations. And those emissions are caused by two things. A manufactured substance known as clinker is a key component in cement. And making that requires these ultra-hot kilns that typically reach 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit. And I had a hard time wrapping my head around how hot that is, but it's a quarter of the temperature of the sun's surface. So a lot of fossil fuels are used to fire those kilns, at least in the U.S. And in Europe, they often use other materials that are less carbon intensive. And then part of the process that releases even more CO2 is this chemical reaction that is used to, I won't get into the wonky details, but it's part of the process of making cement.
You mentioned Europe, but what are the alternatives to this carbon-heavy process?
Yeah, there are already a number of lower carbon cements available on the market. They're made by using other materials, such as slag from iron blast furnaces, and those are used in the place of some of the carbon-intensive clinker. And a number of companies have been developing extremely low carbon cement products using things like algae. But there are also some obstacles to all of that. These low carbon cements tend to be a little bit more expensive. And the construction industry is risk averse. You know, as one person told me, they are risk averse for a reason. You know, they don't want these buildings to collapse. The products that are on the market have been proven to be very strong, but some of them have different properties. They take longer to cure, takes longer to harden. And in the construction industry, time is money.
So how is the Biden administration going about addressing this issue? This was something that was in their sights.
They did a number of things. The EPA under the Biden administration awarded 21 grants aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions from concrete, cement, and other construction materials. And the Department of Energy had awarded $1.5 billion in grants to projects designed to curb emissions by the cement industry. The IRA, Biden's massive climate law, also provided $2.2 billion for the purchase of low-carbon construction materials for planned federal buildings.
And what has this Trump administration done to sort of slow down this decarbonization of the industry?
Well, what we know for sure is that the 21 EPA grants that were designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from construction materials were canceled. They were canceled in February.
What do people inside the industry say about all this?
Well, I've talked with officials from two of the big trade associations for the cement and concrete industries, and they say the industry is working really hard to decarbonize. They've got goals to completely decarbonize the industry by 2050. But without government support, they say, the efforts to do that will be slowed. I think they're as curious as I am about what the next 4 years will bring.
Why is the industry looking to decarbonize?
I think they understand that there's public sentiment for doing that, that there's an appetite among customers to try to, you know, reduce the carbon footprint of multiple industries. So I think that's the key driver. And, you know, they got encouragement from the Biden administration along with a lot of money to try to move in this direction.
Is there anything else that you would want people to know about this or that I should have asked you about?
I guess one thing to know, the cement industry's carbon footprint has grown a lot. In the last 30 years, carbon emissions by this industry have nearly tripled. And, you know, there's going to be a lot more demand for concrete in the next 25 years. The projections are that there will be 50% more concrete used in the world by 2050. So, you know, at the same time that there are efforts to decarbonize this industry, there's going to be a lot more concrete being used globally.
Is that because there's just more development in the world?
Yeah, and particularly in the global south. Yes.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me about this.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
Ames Alexander is an investigative reporter at Floodlight, a news outlet looking into the corporations and political interests stalling climate action. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple back in April. We checked back with Alexander this week for an update. He says federal funds for decarbonizing concrete and other building materials, including those 21 EPA grants he mentioned and more than $1 billion in Department of Energy grants, have been terminated or rescinded. The popularity of birding boomed during the pandemic and continues to grow. One couple in Ohio who birds together has started making art together as well, interpreting bird songs for a multimedia project. Egal Kaufman of IdeaStream Public Media has their story.
Monica Bowman is an artist and communications specialist for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. She's been an avid birder since childhood.
Those are juncos. They're very cute. Classic Ohio winter bird. I think winter birding is the best because you can see through the leaves and things.
We're out at the Oak Hill Trailhead at the Cuyahoga Valley National Park. It's Thanksgiving morning and it's cold out with snow blanketing the trails. On a day already closely associated with birds, Bowman is looking to enjoy them without the stuffing.
I think that being outside and listening for something is really magical.
Now Bowman has found a way to bring that magic indoors. She and her partner, Akron-based jazz saxophonist Chris Coles, have started an ambitious art project called Avomancy. It's a complex and evolving animal that aims to take flight as a combination of visual arts, dance, music, film, and live performance. But it all started with a simple camping trip.
So we were camping in the Valley Overlook in the Cuyahoga Valley National Park, and we were awakened by the sound of the wood thrush.
The wood thrush became Chris Coles' spark bird, basically the one that got him into birding. And it didn't take long for him to see a possible intersection of the bird song and his music.
After hearing the wood thrush, it was just like, oh, I think I'm going to transcribe this.
Since then, Bowman and Coles have recorded hundreds of bird sounds for the project, adding more with every birding trip they take. At the National Choreography Center in Akron, they gathered with other jazz musicians and a unique percussive dance troupe to start playing with the sounds they'd gathered. The day started off with the musicians set up around Bowman for a lesson about the birds who would be their bandmates.
Black in the skies in the fall there. I'm from Texas originally, so yeah, I used to laugh.
They learned about bird calls, their habitats, and the particular sounds they'd be working with. Then Coles played the samples of the calls with some of the rhythmic and ambient alterations he had already made, while the group discussed possibilities. They chose two calls for this jam session workshop, the wood thrush and a trumpeter swan. And then the vibe took hold, as it's known to do. Riffing off the sound of the trumpeter swan, the musicians started immediately forming a melody, and the dancers started a rhythmic conversation, accentuated by the exotic beats coming from the percussion.
So we're in the little baby bird phase of our project. That's why we would call this a creative play date. We're Archaeopteryx in the evolutionary time of our project.
She's referring to the evolutionary ancestor who sat flightless at the intersection of dinosaurs and birds. Back out on the trail, we see some of their very distant descendants. There's mergansers floating out on the water like ducks, as well as a mixed flock of smaller birds feeding on the ground. Some tufted titmice hanging out with a cardinal that looks like it hopped off Bob Gibson's jersey. We also hear a woodpecker, a golden-crowned kinglet, and some chickadees.
A lot of the birds that come to Ohio, period, come through Northeast Ohio. You know, we're so close to the lakes, and that's like a great place. After the birds come down from the north, they gotta stop somewhere.
For me, it's a beautiful day on Ohio's trails. For Monica Bowman, it's a lifelong dedication to art and wildlife. And now, a rare opportunity to bring those two loves together with a third, her partner, Chris Coles. For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Egal Kaufman.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front, an independent nonprofit radio show produced in Pittsburgh. If you miss an episode, find the Allegheny Front podcast each week at our website, alleghenyfront.org/episodes, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can sign up for our newsletter while you're there. It drops every Tuesday morning. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. Additional reporting this week from WHYY's Susan Phillips. I'm Julie Grant. Kara Holsoppel will be back next week.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Heinz Endowments, the Laurel Foundation, and the Community Foundation for the Alleghenies. The Park Foundation support our coverage of climate and energy. The Richard King Mellon Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, and the Robert F. Schumann Foundation support our coverage of conservation. The Allegheny Front is supported by Press Forward, the nationwide movement to strengthen communities by invigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news.